Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Jern, Daisy.
And we are the Shock Doctors. In this episode, we're going to be discussing Swallow, which is about a pregnant woman who develops a rather nasty case of pica. For those of you who don't know what that is, and that's a reasonable position to be in.
I keep wanting to call it parvo, which is something that afflicts puppies.
Right.
Pound puppies.
It's a compulsion to eat inedible objects, non-organic objects. Like, we'll just list off a couple examples from this movie. A marble.
Safety pin.
A battery.
Jack, like the game of jacks.
Yeah, and so on. So, yeah, it's this movie is not strictly a horror movie, but the pica is unpleasant enough, and we were squicked out enough by the trailer that we figured, oh, what the hell.
Let's yeah, it's a stomach-churning premise, obviously, for those of you who are hoping that the protagonist had an interest in ornithology. You will be sorely disappointed. The film has nothing to do with that kind of swallow and everything to do with, as my co-host said, a very macabre oral fixation.
Yes.
So, we open with a happily engaged couple. What are their names?
Hunter and Richie.
Hunter is with child, we soon learn. She's expecting. We know this. We learn a couple things right off the bat because Richie announces over the phone, we're pregnant. So we learn that she's pregnant and he's a douchebag in one fell swoop.
Right. That always rubs me the wrong way. Some people feel that that's the appropriate thing to say nowadays. It shows that the male partner is invested in the process and they're in it together. But no, that's just, I've always thought it was obnoxious.
It's we like, might be pregnant, but we are not having morning sickness.
Right.
We are not shitting our brains out as we expel a child in a hospital bed.
Yeah, it strikes me as disrespectful. My wife, my partner, is pregnant.
We are expecting.
We are having a baby.
Yeah, we are expecting. We are expecting. Live with. We're pregnant is just.
We have a kid on the way. It's a stupid convention that I think is disrespectful.
There's a celebratory dinner with Hunter and her baby daddy and his parents, and it's strained and awkward, and Hunter starts telling a story about some local nutter that she remembers from her childhood. I can't remember what prompts this, but it's contextually relevant.
So Richie's mom is talking about how when he was a baby, he preferred the cat's tail to his pacifier, which is a new one on me, so that's kind of amusing. But then
there's been a very docile cat or a frighteningly fast baby.
Right.
I'm imagining something from Train Spotting. Clambering all over the ceiling.
Right. So he, feeling embarrassed, subsequently presses Hunter to tell a story that she really doesn't want to tell, and
he volunteers
drag it out of her.
Yeah, Hunter was a freak too, you know,
basically
something like
yeah.
that. Gets so, him and gets his wife or fiance in his parents' crosshairs instead.
So she starts telling this story about this again local nutter from her childhood who would like blow kisses to every passing car on this particular stretch of road.
He was proselytizing for some fringe religious group that he was affiliated with.
Yeah, it's like Will Patton in Minari dragging his gigantic cross everywhere. It's that same kind of religious obligation that everyone else thinks is fucking bizarre.
The mother cuts her off. Or no, the father cuts her off.
With some business thing.
Yeah, starts talking business, talking shop with his son. You know, it's one of those would-be quick asides. Oh, before I forget. But then it dovetails into a total non sequitur.
Yeah, it just turns into a work conversation outright.
And so Hunter looks chastened. And then we get a very... It reminded me of the shot in Taxi Driver of Travis staring at the tablet dissolving in the glass of water.
Mm-hmm.
She's just staring down into her glass, which is nothing but ice at this point, and the ice is kind of melting and crinkling and scraping against the glass, and she picks out an ice cube and really goes to town on it, crunches on it loudly, and kind of gets everyone else's attention at the table, and she goes like, oh, I'm sorry, this ice is the bomb, or something like that.
This ice is awesome.
I think that is what she says. This ice is totally awesome.
Yeah.
And I'm a freak for ice. Ice is among my favorite snack foods. I could eat it by the pound. I'm something of a connoisseur. Jimmy John's has really good ice, because not all ice is created equal. And hospital ice, this makes it sound like I was committed. Hospital for this disorder. Hospital ice is really good. Any ice that's like not too hard on the teeth. You know, I'm not trying to crack a molar open or anything. But and in any case, if I was like at dinner with some chick and she said, "Oh, this ice is great," that, I know it's supposed to be a red flag. It's a red flag.
But it's not for Matt.
Yeah, would have completely passed me by.
Well, you know, if you had been institutionalized for compulsively eating ice, you wouldn't know what hospital ice was like, because they wouldn't give it to you.
That's true. All right.
So there's your excuse. Your rationalization.
We get a bunch of sequences of Hunter at home in this kind of prim 50s housewife attire, being a homemaker and trying to fix the place up. I think they've recently moved there. Some of the banter with her and her husband or husband-to-be indicates that they're still getting the lay of the land.
I don't know why you keep saying husband. They're married. They're definitely married.
Okay.
I don't know where the confusion's coming from. Later on, not to put the cart before the horse, but father-in-law is talking about Richie getting a divorce. So obviously that wouldn't be necessary if they were pre-marriage.
True that.
And not to mention these rich, bougie fucks probably wouldn't want their son
tying the knot with a crazy
shotgun wedding sort of thing.
Right.
So yeah, no, the parents, in addition to dad giving his son this new promotion, which is the other thing that gets announced early on, they also bought them this fucking outrageously nice house. And Hunter spends much of her time, as Matt said, trying to tidy the place up and decorate it and so forth.
There's some business. Well, we'll get to that when we get to it. Someone, I think it's the mother or mother-in-law, gifts her this self-help book called, I think, A Talent for Joy.
Yes.
Or an affinity for bliss, or something stupid like that. A proclivity for cheer. I don't know. And Hunter starts reading
from
it.
An aptitude for contentment.
And one of the bits of inane advice on the inside is, I can't remember, do something every day to surprise yourself, or don't be afraid to try new things.
Just do something like unexpected. That.
Right.
Like, yeah.
It's a shame that Hunter didn't scan down the page a little further and see the parenthetical that goes, wait, no, not like that. because what she proceeds to do...
That could have forestalled the whole movie.
Yeah, right.
Right. There.
What she proceeds to do is eat a marble. She fishes a good-sized marble out of a little tray on top of a sort of coffee table, glass coffee table.
Not one of the big ones, though. She manages her expectations to start off with. She grabs the normal size, not the oversized marble.
And our expectations, or at least mine, because given the premise, I kind of figured she would go directly for the thumbtack. We're not forestalling that offend by very much, unfortunately.
No, the pushpin is the second item, which she does not immediately actually swallow. She puts it in her mouth, spits it out onto the counter,
goes
walks
into the
to the other end of the room.
Well, she makes it into the bathroom. She inspects her tongue, which is bleeding. She nicked it, and then looks like she's come to her senses, and then she succumbs to the compulsion, runs over, and horks down the pushpin. And that whole sequence is a little bit of a roller coaster for me, not just for the obvious reason, because I kept thinking, oh, good, it would be too soon to escalate like this. We can't go right from marble to pushpin. You know, we got to save the thumbtack for the grand finale. Otherwise, where do we go from there? Is she going to become like a circus sword swallower? So I thought that the movie had kind of read my mind on that score, but then she goes right ahead and eats it anyway. And from there on out, I don't know, I'll talk about this more after the break. I think that the pacing suffers a little bit because she graduates up to sharp objects so quickly, but that also frees the movie up to go in some kind of unanticipated directions, so it's a blessing and a curse. She passes the marble, she passes the pushpin, the second BM is kind of a dicey affair.
For obvious reasons.
And also because her husband is banging on the door and trying to get in while she's cleaning up the crime scene. There's blood on the toilet seat. She's trying to maintain a perfect house and not let him know that anything is awry.
Well, plus he's brought some people home, some work colleagues.
And plus, she's pregnant, so she couldn't even pass it off as, oh, sorry, honey,
that time of the month.
Right, exactly. It's going to look like a medical emergency
if
she's bleeding into the toilet. So she's got company. They've got company. We've got company. We're pregnant.
We're having company. We're having a friend for dinner.
Mm-hmm.
Clarice.
One of the friends is a real creeper who asks her for a hug because he's lonely. And she says, why? And he says, because I'm not drunk enough to ask you for a kiss. And it's a weird exchange because it sounds rehearsed on his part, but you can't imagine how that could be, because why would you ever say that more than once? It's like, if you busted that line out on your buddy's wife, one time is all it should take.
Well, I mean, it may have been rehearsed, but that doesn't mean, you know, it had... This could be the first live fire exercise,
that could
so to speak.
That could be.
You know, he could have practiced this in front of a mirror dozens of times.
In any case, she placates him, goes in for the hug, and then she kind of leans into it, and it's played very delicately because it's not like seduction, at least not on her end. She's just that starved for affection that she actually does get something out of it. This very chaste embrace that they share. And you don't see his face at all, so you don't know what he's getting out of it. But afterwards, she thanks him, and he says, you're welcome. All right, let's not forget who's doing who a favor here. Next up, onto the main event, she eats a battery. Not a triple A, either. It's, you know, looks like a good-sized Duracell.
I mean, it's a double A. It's not like a D battery something.
Fair. It's not going to be like a choking hazard, but it's going to be hazardous in other ways. Every time she eats something like that in this movie, especially anything jagged, I just kept thinking, like, God, put it in a ball of peanut butter first, like you're giving a dog his medicine. That's the least you could do. Let it at least be normal when it's going down your throat. Get weird once it hits your stomach.
There's a shot about midway through the movie because she passes all of these items and fishes them all out of the toilet.
And then she keeps a little memento collection on a dish in her bedroom.
And there's this one little like sculpture trinket that's like a tiny bust, like marble bust almost looks like.
It reminded me of the mermaid from The Lighthouse. The little like mermaid statuette.
A little bit.
That Robert Pattinson plays with. But the arms are like spread out and
it's
the elbows.
Jesus, how did you even swallow that? God forbid you had to. Well, I know you had to pass it. Jesus Christ.
Yeah, she's prepping for birth, I guess. After that, it's going to hold no horrors for her. Speaking of her impending birth, they go in to get an ultrasound, check on the baby. The woman administering the ultrasound says, oh, it looks like there's some other obstruction down there. It's probably just a glitch. And then it pushes in a little further with the ultrasound device. I forget what the wand is called. And Hunter winces. It's more than a wince, really. I mean, she audibly gasps. And then she's rushed into surgery. And a whole bunch of stuff is removed from her belly forcibly. Her stomach is pumped.
And this is where we see the jack and another battery, I think, and just all manner of stuff. Next thing we know, Richie and Hunter are in their bedroom, and he's just going on a tirade while also throwing out all the small objects in the room.
Yeah, anything. I almost said edible. Not edible, but anything.
Swallowable.
Yeah, any.
Ingestible.
Yeah. It's like he's baby-proofing the room. Like anything a toddler could get its hands on, that might be a problem if it tried teething with it.
Yeah, and when I say tirade, I mean he's just berating her nonstop, like, so fucked up, why would you do this? I think if she knew why, she might not be doing it. I don't know.
Also, it's not clear if the disorder predates the marriage. It seems like it's a stress response to her current circumstances.
Yeah, he seems to think that, oh, well, this is something you should have told me before we got married. And she basically says it wasn't a thing before we got married. So, yeah, I think that's exactly what it is. It's just a fucking stress response to being in this pressure cooker, god-awful marriage. And shortly after this, she starts going to therapy. Basically comes right out and says, makes me feel in control. And that clearly makes sense because she has absolutely no control over her life otherwise. You know, she's a girl who basically came from nothing and didn't have a lot of prospects and then just met this rich guy and married him. And now he and his parents, her in-laws, they just hold it over her. You know, sometimes a little more implicitly and sometimes a lot more explicitly.
It only gets more explicit as she becomes, you know, more disenfranchised throughout this whole process that plays out for the remainder of the movie. Movie at this point falls into a rhythm where she's going to therapy, and we get therapy scenes interspersed with domestic scenes. And at first, they don't even want her to have solo talk therapy. They want to supervise that too. And in a way, they continue to supervise it. More on that momentarily. Doctor-patient confidentiality kind of goes out the window in this movie. There's another party. She's serving finger sandwiches to the guests, and one of the lady guests makes a self-disparaging remark about, oh, if I eat any more of those, I'm going to have to get my stomach pumped. You know, record scratch.
And the fact that it's a record scratch,
right,
is the real problem.
If she had let that slip, then's the time to bite your tongue and not betray the fact that it's public knowledge that Hunter has an eating disorder of a kind.
Right.
But instead, she starts apologizing profusely, which is exactly the wrong thing to do.
And everyone is looking.
Mm-hmm.
Party has come to a halt.
Hunter confronts her husband about this, and it's his birthday party. He makes a real to-do about how, you know, she's going to spoil his birthday if she keeps acting up.
You're the dickhead who aired this very private information to your entire office.
Yeah, you spoiled your birthday, my man. In therapy, Hunter drops this bombshell. She had previously been about to talk about her mother. Therapist keeps prying her, you know, trying to get her to open up about her childhood, which she insists was totally normal. Eventually,
idyllic, even.
Eventually, Hunter says, it comes about so oddly. Oh, I guess you want me to talk about the rape thing, I think she says. And then she regales her therapist with the circumstances of her birth, which were violent and traumatic. Her mother was raped by a guy that she met at a bar who subsequently served time. And she carries around a little postage stamp sized picture of him.
It's like a mugshot cut out of the paper.
Yeah, right. And the therapist is a little bit perturbed by that.
Justifiably so, I think.
So perturbed, in fact, that she follows up with the husband about it. Hunter overhears the two of them on the phone when she's at home shortly thereafter, and the husband is basically demanding that the therapist give him the skinny on all of his wife's baggage. The therapist proceeds to do so.
Really can't do that. And then he says, he basically does the equivalent of saying, come on.
You know you wanna.
The therapist is like, okay, well, there was a rape. And I thought that
she was
going to be
leave
the
it
end.
At that. Yeah,
leave it at that, and then he would think that this happened to Hunter, and then decide she was damaged goods or
that she was at
like
fault
that.
Somehow.
Or yeah, I mean, knowing this fucked up rich ass family, they would probably blame her for it. But then the therapist does end up disclosing the actual details.
And even at the point when the therapist says, I'm not at liberty to discuss that or whatever she says, she had already let slip too much.
Right.
Even having that phone call was inappropriate. And so he's right in a sense that she's drawing the line somewhat arbitrarily.
Sure.
It might as well be all or nothing. So this sends Hunter into a little bit of a tailspin. She, we've elided this character. They have a live-in nurse now at the rich-ass family's insistence. Someone who took care of a ailing relative,
grandmother.
And he's this gruff, he looks like a Serbian gangster the first time you see him. He looks like if he was just wearing a tracksuit, you would swear that he was like an extra in Eastern Promises or something.
Right. I think, as it turns out, I think he's Syrian. And whether he would be technically classified as a refugee or not, he left because of the war, essentially. This comes out.
Yeah, he and Hunter discussed that fairly tersely. He's trying to figure out what her hang-ups are and doesn't seem to have much patience for them because she's got this pampered life.
If you had been in war, you would not have these mind problems. In war, there is no time for mind problems. So, no, just later.
It was one of my favorite Strong Bad emails.
Well, you know, what... While we were watching the movie, I did an impression of the guy the first time, and he came out sounding Russian, and so I was trying to avoid that, and yeah, you're right, that sounded like Strong Bad. I'm bad at this impression, I guess.
So this guy up until now has had a very no-nonsense...
Oh, Trevor!
very no-nonsense attitude, no bedside manner to speak of. And here he did something that surprised and a little bit delighted me. Hunter crawls under the bed to be alone, and he crawls in after her. It looks at first like he's just going to grab her by the ankles and pull her out
right.
And like slap her around probably and just be a brute. But instead, he goes down there and they kind of commiserate. He squeezes her shoulder. And there again, I thought the scene could take a turn for the worse. But just as with the creepy hug from before, that little bit of physical contact seems to do her some good. So they both bed down for the night, basically, under the bed. She wakes up before he does, slithers out without disturbing him, and attempts to ingest. It's in silhouette. It's at night. What I took to be like a miniature ice pick, I didn't know what I was looking at first.
After they remove it, we can see more clearly. It's one of those like eyeglass repair screwdrivers, you know, with the round sort of disc handle on one end and then the tiniest possible little Phillips head on the other.
So obviously ingesting a battery or ingesting sharp objects can read as potentially suicidal. I don't think there's any expectation that she was actually going to get this down and pass it. In any case, she is taken to the hospital, and afterwards she is threatened with institutionalization. They are talking about carting her off, the parents, the husband, and she understandably does not want to remain under their thumb anymore because she's got just no leeway, and 24-hour supervision is only going to make things worse. So the nurse, sensing this, helps her escape. And there's a line here which I thought was rather nicely put, where she's about to get in the car to be taken away to some kind of sanitarium, and the mother-in-law says, "Oh, give me your engagement ring." And that I think was why I was thinking of them as betrothed, because that line read to me as like the marriage is off, you know.
Right.
Which I can be read that way either way.
The marriage is over.
Right.
After having taken place.
Right.
It is now off.
And anyway, it's a thematically resonant moment for any number of reasons.
Yeah. I mean, this comes on the heels of the line I mentioned earlier where the father-in-law says, you know, sign these commitment papers
right.
or Richie wants a divorce. Very pointedly, Richie does not say he wants a divorce. His dad says it for him, the fucking spineless prick.
Well, Richie does the same thing when the nurse is introduced. He tries to sell Hunter on the idea and then caves and goes, "Mom, this was your idea. Why don't you explain it to her?"
Yeah, but this time he doesn't even like try and do that. It's just dad blurts this out. But then Richie still tries to do his like phony ass, like, "Oh, you know, you're going to be fine. Or everything's going to go back to just for a little while." It's like, okay, your family's threatening divorce. This is not fine. Fuck you.
Yeah, she's effectively a baby incubator at this point. Give or take 8 months, they're going to want nothing to do with her. So, with the aid of Nurse Strongbad, she flies the coop, escapes through a bathroom window.
Nurse Bad.
And flees into the woods, hitches a ride at the nearest road, and absconds to a motel for the evening.
The North Shore Mo.
Yes, it's the North Shore Motel, but a bunch of letters have winked out. So we had a good long laugh about a scenic North Shore Mo, which I hear is lovely this time of year.
So after Hunter's been at the motel for a little while, she calls Richie, who's with his father in the car. They've been presumably driving around looking for her. And he's very solicitous after her at first. You know, "Are you okay? You know, where are you? I miss you," et cetera, et cetera. "You know, please come back. I want it to go back to the way it was."
Yeah. And we don't buy this for a lot of reasons. We've spent a whole movie with him at this point. In terms of the visual language at play here, he's standing behind an idling car. And so the tail lights give him kind of a demonic bearing.
Red,
even
yeah.
Before he has his heel turn in a second here.
Yeah, and Hunter's like, "Yeah, I miss you too. Okay, so just come back." No, I can't. And it's not long before the C word comes out.
He threatens to hunt her down. It basically turns into the opening 10 minutes of Invisible Man from this past year.
Yes.
He says, "I'm going to hunt you down, you ungrateful cunt," this, that, and the other. And she says, "Okay, I got to go." And very meekly hangs up.
Then proceeds to smash her phone with a lamp.
Mm-hmm. And she does not ingest the pieces when she's finished.
So no.
Progress.
She doesn't. Although she does later that night proceed to have just like a little tidy pile of dirt.
Yeah, from a potted plant, I assume.
Well, no, we see her, like, picking up dirt from, like, a flower bed outside the motel, I think, earlier on. So she's got this tiny little pile of dirt on her duvet cover on the bed. And she's just, like, watching TV and eating the dirt like popcorn.
Like a sad earthworm. Yeah, just glassy-eyed staring at the TV. Wakes up there. There's a fake out where there's some banging on the door, and it's just someone there to change the linen or whatever.
A very insistent member of the housekeeping staff.
Mm-hmm. So she checks out, calls her mother, asks for a place to stay, is at first gently rebuffed, then not so gently.
Well, it's even more of a 180 than that, because at first it sounds like, yeah, you know, it'd be nice to see you. It's like, but it's just not a good time right now, because, you know, your sister's here with the new baby. I won't get in the way. There's no room.
Click.
Basically. I'm exaggerating, but only a little.
So instead, she
Hunter
goes
immediately hangs up.
Mm-hmm. And instead, Hunter goes to see her father, who is out of prison.
Yes.
They have never met. I was not expecting the movie to veer in this direction. It was, you know, prepared for with the therapy exposition, but it's a strange note to end on, and I kind of appreciated it more on that after the break. She goes to, it's another birthday boy, wouldn't you know. She crashes this dude's birthday party. He's got a wife and a child and a bunch of friends who all clearly think the world of him. So she, just by her presence there, is implicitly threatening to just blow up his whole scene. It takes him a while to figure out who she is.
Well, yeah, he has no idea who she is. Look kind of familiar, you know. I'm sure we've met before and blah, blah, blah. I'm so-and-so's daughter. And she says this while the wife and the kid are in the room. So he, like,
tries to usher them out.
It dawns on him immediately, as it would, you know, that stands to reason, but he keeps a lid on it and, yeah, kind of directs his family out of the room, and then it's very much like, you know, what do you want?
They proceed to have a heart-to-heart, and it's as volatile as you'd expect. He tells her, he's sort of been violently humbled by his time in prison. He talks about how rape was a power trip for him. It made him feel like he was in control.
Like he was God.
Right. And then his stint in prison, he was on the receiving end of God knows what. It was at least had the shit kicked out of him. He alludes to that. And
the phrase colostomy bag comes mm-hmm. into play here. It's like, then I realized I wasn't God. I was shit.
She asks, am I like you? He says, not sure, which is understandable because they've only just met. And she indicates, you know, she needs him to at least extend her the benefit of the doubt, I guess. He says she needs to hear it from him, I think is what she says, to which he responds, you're not me. Just factually the case. I think it's a really surprisingly tender note to end on, considering how this sequence begins.
Yes.
You know, just the circumstances and all of the elements at play here. She leaves and makes arrangements to terminate her pregnancy. She acquires pills to that end, which have to be held in the mouth before being swallowed. So it's kind of a strange culmination of her disorder, mm-hmm. which is it's as though the not parvo, the pica, is that right?
Pica, yeah.
Pica. So as though the pica has been leading her here all along in this strangely prophetic way, which I thought was kind of interesting. So she miscarries in a bathroom, public bathroom, comes out, and the film ends on this bit of a groaner of a shot of a succession of women going into and out of bathroom stalls and washing their hands while the credits roll.
Yeah, it's one of those, it's a static shot where she walks out of her stall, washes her hands, and walks out of the bathroom, and then we stay there. And this is not an uncommon style of closing shot, but here, yeah, it's just kind of obnoxious.
Well, and it's one of those final shots where we realize it's the final shot because the camera lingers the way that it does, and then we realize there's a song playing, you know, some kind of soft rock ballad with a piano, and we realize that the shot is only lingering for the exact duration it is because they're waiting for some note, like some, like, plunk of the piano for the, you know, directed by credit to
right.
come up on screen. And that always feels just kind of artificially wrought to me. It's not as bad as the final shot of Joker, not to open up that can of worms again. I had the same beef with the ending of Joker. I realized it was just the shot of the hospital hallway
right.
with Joaquin Phoenix running back and forth for what feels like half an hour.
It's
just
it
killing
wasn't?
Time. It very well might have been.
I could have sworn it was. Well, We can get into more detail about the closing shot and everything else
of this movie.
Right, after the break.
How does it make you feel when you swallow something?
I just like the textures in my mouth. It made me feel in control.
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at Shock Doctors Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/shockdoctorspod, or check us out on Apple Podcasts. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
I'm right here.
I just wanted to make you happy.
You get back here with my kid!
I did something unexpected today.
And we're back. So I guess just to tie off the point about the closing shot, obviously the takeaway is like, any one of these women could have been Hunter. That's so facile.
Or all of these women are Hunter to varying degrees.
Yeah, I mean, it's variations on a theme. A theme that is not at all revelatory, which is clearly what this is supposed to be, at least to some degree.
And a shot like that could have felt like a eureka moment in different hands. I have to believe it comes down to execution, because it's not as though the filmmaker's values in mind, you know, I mean, there's probably no way for me to say down with the patriarchy without sounding like a total knob, but you know, I'm on board with the premise of the shot. I think it is just the fact for me that you have the time-killing exercise of waiting for the right moment to punctuate, written and directed by so-and-so. That just makes it feel like, rather than, it makes it feel like a death rattle rather than like an exhalation when it finally arrives. You know, it's just such, anticlimax isn't even the word for it. It's just such a weak note to end your movie on.
Yeah, I mean,
it wasn't as bad, and I said this after the lights came up, so to speak. It's not like we were watching this in a theater.
It wasn't soon.
It wasn't as bad as the final shot of Nocturne from 10 or so episodes back, but it was
a lot longer ago than
really?
That.
Christ. Time flies, but it was, as I said, a groaner all the same.
Yeah, I mean, I don't object to the point. I object to the fact that they're trying to make it in this sort of ostentatious look at this still shot that's not particularly interesting to look at either. You know, it's not like the shot is so visually compelling that it overcomes my knee-jerk hostility to how blatant it is. It's just, I don't know. I don't want to exaggerate and say the rest of the movie is flawless with this analogy, but it's like a piano that's perfectly in tune except for one key, and that key is the last key you hit.
Yeah, I had a weird... Well, before we move on, part of the problem here, I think, is that other than one woman standing in front of the mirror applying makeup, you know, which is a performative femininity thing, or at least it could be read that way, all of the other women are just performing basic hygiene.
Right.
You know, it's not like the rest of them have come there to precipitate a miscarriage. You know, so they all kind of come and go in a way that feels, it feels drab, like you were kind of getting at. I mean, it's visually drab, and then just the behavior we're seeing. Something about it just makes me feel like I was, for some reason, too conscious of the fact that I was watching extras, actresses hitting marks and like entering and exiting the frame on cue. Something about the design of the whole thing just felt very inauthentic.
Yeah.
I had a weird relationship with this movie, and it did hit some false notes for me even before we get to that ending. There were a fair bit of ups and downs. That's part of the reason I was so tickled by the moment when the male nurse crawls under the bed to give her moral support, because up until that point, he'd been an unsympathetic, one-note, ancillary antagonist.
Right.
He was muscle. He was hired muscle. And up until that point, none of the characters, Hunter included, had really done anything that felt spontaneous until he pursues her under the bed. And that was kind of the movie's first curveball for me. Obviously, her eating habits are out of the ordinary, but that's also this movie's elevator pitch. So you go in knowing to expect that sort of thing. That doesn't come out of the blue. It probably can't. unless you go in completely blind and think this is a movie about birds. So there wasn't enough of that sort of organic spontaneity for me. Her relationship with her husband is so lukewarm and lackluster right off the bat, and they're both so kind of mealy-mouthed about everything. I mean, she's such a wallflower, and he's so on his phone that it's hard to imagine, you know, when he alludes to the good old days at the end when he's trying to lure her back, again, awash in the glow of the taillight. The satanic red glow. It's hard to imagine what he could possibly be referring to.
Well, for me, I know exactly what he's referring to. He's referring to
when he had her on a short leash.
When he had her on a short leash, yeah. And had her cooking his dinners so he could sit there and say a few words to her and then send work emails during dinner. Those were the good old days for him. And then, you know, have sex on demand, presumably.
Right.
Shit like that. So his definition of the good old days bears no resemblance to how we would define it, and that's just who he is.
That's fair. I mean, I expect that their honeymoon would look pretty depressing and that their idea of marital bliss was always a gilded cage. But obviously the sort of story here is the yellow wallpaper. I fucking love the yellow wallpaper. And I think, obviously, it's the yellow wallpaper is a diary being kept by the main character. And so you get so much more of her interiority than you get of Hunter's. And that's just the nature of the medium. And I'm not saying I would have wanted a version of this movie that was wall-to-wall with narration. I don't want Hunter to necessarily keep a diary and go through all of her thoughts on a day-in, day-out kind of basis. But she's so tight-lipped, even when she's in therapy, she insists everything's fine. You're making such a big deal out of this. It's no big deal. And I understand that because she's a character who's used to being cut off and interrupted and talked down to. So she doesn't have that much to, she doesn't really wear anything on her sleeve. But there was a kind of lack of introspection that I found frustrating after a certain point because she doesn't really know why she's doing what she's doing. But it's fairly apparent to us that it's a product of this shitty, loveless marriage. And indeed, the first thing that she ingests, the marble, has this kind of cloudy red. I mean, it looks like a fetus. It looks like it's a pretty explicit stand-in for the baby that she's harboring. You know, and there's shots of, you know, she'll eat something. I think it's after the thumb stat. Harboring like it's an alien parasite.
Like it's a fugitive. Well, you're harboring that baby in your womb.
When you're talking about body horror as a genre, that is basically what you're dealing with. It's a parasitic life form. I think most movie births, I mean, most movie deliveries do not get as close to the physical reality of going into labor as Alien. So, or maybe that speaks to my own weird biases where fatherhood is concerned. I do kind of, to me, the idea of being pregnant, it is like having a tapeworm. You know, I view it with that kind of level of distaste. Obviously, your mileage may vary when it comes to movies and when it comes to
parenthood,
having offspring. What was I going on about? She'll eat something and then she'll reach down and rub her belly in this sort of warm maternal way, but she has more warmth and affection for the thumbtack that she just ingested than she does for this baby that she manifestly does not want.
Right.
And for this marriage that she manifestly does not want. And so it just, the fact that this stuff is so clear to the audience, provided the audience is paying attention, and appears to not be clear to her, or at least she's in a very deep state of denial about it, that engenders some frustration that makes the first part of this movie, if you're me, a little bit of a slog. And then once she springs loose from the trap and runs off into the woods and makes it out to North Shoremo, where I have a summer home. North Shoremo, when you're here, you're family.
Like a fucking Olive Garden.
Is that where I'm getting that slogan from? Fuck, okay, well. My home away from home, truly.
When you're here, you're eating.
Dirt by the fistful.
Just like Olive Garden.
Yeah, right. Got him.
Got him.
Then the movie picked up for me, and her tete-a-tete with her father was quite affecting, because she comes into it with a fair bit of bravado. You know, she's enjoying the power trip to a certain extent. She makes him say, "I'm in charge here." You know, she has an "I am the captain now" moment.
"Look at me."
In no uncertain terms. And he seems to recognize something of himself in that. I mean, we all enjoy calling the shots, but it is possible, at least in her mind, it's a reasonable fear that she inherited some kind of psychological sickness from him, that she needs to do drastic, violent, even if it's...
to herself.
Yeah, right. Self-harm. Violent, drastic things in order to achieve that feeling of mastery over her own life. And so their moment that they share in the kitchen is... I don't know. On a writing level, it just kind of felt like a quantum leap above everything that had preceded it. I mean, it's immediately preceded by her talking to her mother on the phone. And the way that scene was written kind of bugged me. The mom keeps calling her doll. This comes down to the delivery, too, partly. The phone call ends with her going, "There's no room here for you, doll." And it just felt like... what are you, Betty Davis? Like, where did that come from? There's just a couple lines like that throughout the movie. It's not really worth getting into. The husband, the way his lines were written and delivered, his performance, I couldn't quite wrap my head around. There was just something unnatural about it. It almost felt like the kind of energy you get from a gay actor playing straight. And I don't think that's actually what it was, but there was just a kind of baseline unnaturalness to a lot of his performance that might just be a consequence of him play acting the role of the happy husband in this.
Yeah, I that's
sham marriage.
That's what I took out of it.
Okay.
Like,
in that case, it's a very astute, well-observed performance.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I wouldn't go so far as to call it a standout or anything, but I do think that that's the effect that is being sought here. I mean, I guess you see it most in that last phone call. You know, a lot of his, like, again, mealy mouth, you know,
cage.
Sweetness,
yeah.
Bullshit, and then seconds later, he's calling her a cunt.
Right.
You know, and when he goes off on her, that feels like the most genuine he is during the whole movie. Not that I don't want to oversell it. It's not like I heard him drop the C-bomb and then like a chill went down my spine.
Yeah,
or anything. It was it wasn't like an Oscar type psychopath sort of performance. This wasn't a Hannibal Lecter moment or something like that.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, you do get a more genuine vibe out of that small snippet of it. And so I think in view of that, the artifice, the apparent artifice of the rest of the performance makes sense, because it is an in-universe performance.
Yeah, it was more of a multiple Migs moment, if anything. I think I can buy that. I think I actually liked both of their performances better when they got angry, hers and his, when she's blowing up at her dad in the kitchen, and then the one other time that she loses her temper, which is when he's confiscating, when he's baby-proofing the bedroom.
Right.
They yell at each other, and the movie comes to life for a second, at least it did for me. The way that he's characterized Richie, I talked about this not that long ago, and for the life of me, I can't remember what episode it would have been, how asshole boyfriends and asshole husbands are sort of in vogue in horror movies right now. It's like Midsommar is a standout example of this.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of, even in horror movies, you know, written and directed by men, this is becoming a stock character. And I think he's such a prick. We didn't even get into all of it. There's a sex scene where she gets off and collapses and he immediately goes, "I didn't finish." Or there's, I don't know. There are other examples, too many to name, probably.
Yes.
And there was a tweet. It wasn't like viral or anything. It had, you know, a few hundred likes when I saw it. It was making the rounds on film Twitter, or at least a certain corner of film Twitter. I saw some months ago that said, Yeah, the boyfriend from Midsommar is such a dick. So you don't want to fuck me now yet, or what? Just like male film snob trying to endear himself to a girl at a party, basically.
Right.
By like, oh, that guy sure is mediocre. Not like me, you know? And that...
Let me show you my script where I made a guy really, really mediocre.
Exactly, right. And that's kind of the vibe I got from this movie at points. Was written, directed by a dude, as far as I'm aware. And so it seemed occasionally like he was at pains to make this guy as dickish as possible in a way that felt, I would hesitate to call it projection. I'm not a therapist, or, you know, but it seemed slightly, methinks the lady doth protest too much, you know, that kind of,
a little bit of performative wokeness
could
perhaps.
Be yeah, and that might have, but part of the reason I maybe didn't buy Ritchie's performance 100% is because the actor was saddled with too many scenes that just made that point too stridently, you know. He couldn't, yeah, you know, necessarily hack all of them, or at least not back to back to back.
Right.
There was another one where she irons a silk tie and he kind of reads her the riot act about it. That was the first moment where I felt...
As passive-aggressively as possible.
Right.
Yeah, he's fucking like, well, don't you have another tie? Not that goes with this shirt. It's like, you rich motherfucker.
Don't lie to me.
You have other ties that go with any given shirt. If you don't, what the fuck is wrong with you? What do you have money for? I mean, Jesus Christ, your parents bought the house. You don't need to make mortgage payments.
So for me, the climax with the father is a step up. It's a cut above. Like I said, it's got some really deft writing in it, which I thought was otherwise a little bit lacking in this movie. And my one really brilliant note, she is there obviously to confront this guy and potentially really destabilize his life, if not outright ruin it. And she still, just force of habit, it's hardwired into her, slips into homemaker mode for a second and is like, oh, let me help you with that. The wife is clearing the table. And it's not like a power move. She just like gets this reflexive like knee jerk, oh, I'm not being helpful, you know, moment where she swoops in and starts helping her collect these plastic plates and plasticware and what have you.
Well, yeah, it's part, I think, knee jerk in that way. And it's also part, she can't get herself to cross the Rubicon in terms of initiating this confrontation.
Mm-hmm.
She's like on the verge of dropping the bomb, and then she loses her nerve a little bit. And so that's how she ends up slipping into this mode, I think.
And it's really well played by the actress, because a moment like that, just on the script, there's several ways you could go with that. And one of them would be like a Glenn Close Fatal Attraction thing. Where, oh, let me help you with that. Where she's like a venomous serpent, you know? It's like, where, you know, she's interacting with the wife in an overly familiar way and trying to make the husband sweat, or the father sweat in this
right.
case. And that's not it at all. It really does feel like an unforced, just homemaker moment for her, where she just kind of defaults to this domestic mode that she's been trapped in for God knows how long. All of their banter is great. He has this good line where he says, a secret makes you strong, which I thought cut to the heart of her eating disorder and the appeal of her eating disorder more than anything that emerged from her therapy.
Yeah.
And the whole movie just kicked it up a notch with that scene for me. And last shot notwithstanding, I think the movie ends on a high note. And I wound up liking it more than I thought I would, really just on the basis of where it goes after she escapes from the bathroom. I was reminded of, this might sound a little bit strange, I think that Lars von Trier has an underrated gift for third act twists. He's not like Shyamalan, you know. It's not something that anyone talks about when they talk about his movies, but if you've seen Dogville or if you've seen The Idiots, I'm not going to spoil either. Both of them have revelations about the protagonist that emerge out of nowhere right near the end that sort of reframe everything you thought you knew about them. And they're both just total knockouts. And I felt some of that same excitement watching this stuff play out with her and her dad. It was muted a little bit because when Hunter talks about it in therapy, it's so matter of fact and she lays it all out so explicitly that there isn't quite that element of surprise. I think that had LVT penned this screenplay in some alternate reality, he would have found a way to drop the most meager hints possible prior to the climax. You would already be in the kitchen when you found out that her mother had been raped and that's who he was and that's why she's here.
Right.
And it would be really earth-shattering instead of what it was, which was unexpected, but not totally, you know, it's tough to ask that of a screenwriter because you run the risk of like pissing off the audience, like where the fuck did this come from, you know, like that's, especially when it's such a delicate subject matter, you don't want to totally blindside people. It's a really tricky prospect, and so I don't blame the guy for wanting to lay a bunch of groundwork beforehand, but I think that does rob the climax of a certain level of suspense or excitement.
Yeah, I think I agree with you on that. And I think that the line during her second or third therapy session, whenever it is, where she comes out and says that eating these objects helps me feel like I'm in control, she didn't need to come right out and say that.
Right.
That's something that we should have been allowed to figure out from context, because frankly, speaking for myself, and I'm sure probably speaking for Matt, kind of figured that out before therapy even started, much right. less before that particular session and that particular announcement. And I think, yeah, if therapy had been more about drip feeding bits and pieces of plausibly troubling information, but not really resolving it into anything. Because the only reason to necessarily come right out and say, you know, this is how Hunter was conceived, is that phone call to the husband where it's like, there was a rape. And then to have him misunderstand it in the way that I expected him to before the therapist then clarifies further. And since they didn't do that, it didn't need to be so explicit in the sessions.
And I understand why that phone call arrives when it does in the way that it does, because it's preceded, I don't think we touched on this, with a scene of Hunter gardening, and she's got a handful of dirt, and she's obviously tempted, but then she pats it down and goes upstairs. She does not succumb to the temptation. Hearing the phone call, overhearing the phone call, is sort of the catalyst for the tailspin that ends with her eating the thing that I took to be an ice pick.
Right.
And getting herself hospitalized. But I think something else could have set that in motion. You don't necessarily have to have all of this stuff emerge in therapy if you want to save it for a third act surprise.
Right.
Any number of things could have happened to set her on that course.
Yeah.
The dirt is worth mentioning, too, because she's wiping tears from her face as she's eavesdropping on her husband.
And she's smearing dirt.
Like war paint. Yeah. Which is kind of a nice shot. It's a nice looking movie overall. There's a window in it, a three-paned like bay window with gels on it, so it looks like the French flag. I don't know if the bars are arranged in the same order, but you got your red, blue, and white, and that's rather eye-catching. There's some shots of her standing by the, it's always the red pane, naturally, given the genre.
Right.
Kind of looking out the window in this room suffused with multicolored light. It's a good-looking flick. I was prepared at, you know, around the 70% marker to characterize it as being superficially pretty but relatively shallow, and then much of what happened in the third act kind of deepened my appreciation of it, again, final shot notwithstanding.
Right. Yeah, I think overall I liked the first two acts of the movie somewhat better than you did, but I will agree with you that the climax is a cut above the rest, so we're in lockstep about that.
Go and read The Yellow Wallpaper. If you haven't, it's a top fiver for me. Just short stories, short horror stories. It's excellent, beyond excellent. And it's such a beautiful sucker punch of a thing, because it's, I think, the definitive example of a story where the political content and the ideological leanings are just endemic to the story being told, and so inextricable. And the like genre pleasure of it and the point, you know, the capital P point of it, are just totally harmonious, or you can't have one without the other. And that's such a obviously, I aspire to be the furthest thing from one of those people who's like, oh, get politics out of such and such, you know, keep it out of our, I even said, you know, even though I take umbrage a little bit with the final shot of this movie, I do see the point that it was going for, and I wholeheartedly endorse that point. But Yellow Wallpaper is just really a little bit of a masterclass in terms of telling a horror story that is unmistakably feminist, like in a way that no one could possibly miss, but without any sense of a point of view that's external from the story being spoon-fed to you. It's just totally of a piece. I don't know what else to say. It speaks for itself. So check out Yellow Wallpaper, Charlotte Perkins Gilman. Movies are usually my beat. There's a new French extreme.
Ours in general.
There's a new French extreme movie. I think it's called In My Skin, which is about a woman who has a normal life who develops a self-mutilation disorder. She just starts, you know, nicking herself with various bladed implements, and it escalates from there, being a product of the new French extreme movement.
Right.
you know, martyrs would be probably the most notorious example of that.
High tension.
Right. So that's worth seeking out. I don't remember it super vividly, but I was reminded of it at various points watching Swallowed, just because they deal with the progression of the disorder, you know, the steady escalation in sort of similar ways, and then the very rapid escalation. But what I'm really going to recommend, and I think this influence is pretty unmistakable. This movie, I think, inherited a lot from Todd Haynes. I'm going to recommend Safe, okay. Julianne Moore, mid-90s, one of my faves. It's about a housewife in a loveless marriage, married to Xander Berkeley, who is the quintessential 90s aloof husband. like that and Candyman is just... He knocks it out of the park both times, and she starts developing these strange, unaccountable symptoms. It looks like panic attacks. They're accompanied by hyperventilating and nosebleeds. It's just this mystery illness that totally decimates her life, which is very structured. It's made in the 90s, but set in the 80s, so you've got a Reagan's America sort of HIV/AIDS climate hanging over the whole thing. She doesn't have AIDS, but she has something that the doctors can't account for, and something that feels like it's completely sabotaging her life and isolating her from her loved ones. And so the analogy there is still pretty sturdy. And then, you know, that's all well and good, but then the movie for me really takes flight at the midway point when she gets drawn into the orbit of this sort of new age health retreat that has culty overtones. And it's just chilling watching her getting subsumed by this outfit out in the wilderness that's not overtly Manson-y or anything. It just feels like it's so low-key. I don't even know how to describe it. I don't even really know how to explain why it has the effect on me that it has. It's the most like plausible depiction of indoctrination or brainwashing I've seen in a movie, because the cult, if you want to call it that, is so unassuming. But, you know, you've got all of these vulnerable people who either have psychological afflictions they can't deal with or illnesses they can't explain, and a charismatic leader. And it's just a total horror movie without any really of the genre trappings that you would expect, other than one of the cultists who is extremely eerie. He's got a very distinctive, staggering walk. You see him loping through the background sometimes like Sasquatch, and it just... totally makes my blood run cold. It's a great, great, great movie. So Safe and Yellow Wallpaper, I would recommend with no reservations. And then In My Skin, if you're into the new French extreme, you'll kind of know what you're getting into. Those are my three recommendations this time around.
Well, I just have the one, so you know, I guess I'll just have to make do with that. This isn't a deep cut, although I think it is not necessarily as oft discussed as it ought to be. I don't hear it come up in conversation about great horror movies nearly enough, although it will crop up on like Time Out lists of great horror movies and things like this. The movie is Possession.
Oh yeah, hell
it
yeah.
It turns 40 this year. It features Isabella Gianni and Sam Neill. They play a married couple living in, I don't know, Vienna or somewhere in Eastern Europe. Got this very sort of Soviet bloc atmosphere to it, which I guess wouldn't really track for Vienna. I don't know.
It does feel coldly Eastern European in like a kind of pan-European communist bloc kind of way. It feels like it's a communist satellite, even if it isn't, culturally somehow, that like contagion has spread.
Right.
It's the best way I can describe it.
So they play a married couple, and basically their marriage is breaking down. Isabella Gianni is kind of falling out of love with her husband, kind of pulling away, and he's not having it, and her behavior gets gradually more erratic, and in response, so does his in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
More shouty and imperious, and... clamping on with both hands, unwilling to let her go. And it's good stuff. I mean, I don't want to give away too much of that movie, so I'm gonna stay light on the details. But if you're listening to this podcast, you know, you like horror movies, there's a good chance you've seen Possession. Probably worth watching again. And if you haven't seen it, you definitely should get on that.
And if you needed more connective tissue, possession depicts I think miscarriage in one scene. It's hard to say exactly what's happening. I, again, don't want to spoil anything, like my co-host, but it gets sort of Lovecrafty towards the end, a little bit more creature feature. And Isabella Gianni has this total tour de force of a scene where she appears to miscarry something or other. Yes. Hard to say. Yeah, I won't elaborate, but the miscarriage in this film is all to do with Hunter's autonomy and with her agency, and it's cathartic and climactic. The one in Possession is just flat out body horror, cosmic horror, soul scarring insanity. And so in a way, the movies have that element in common, but in another sense, they could not be more different. Both worth checking out, though. I like Possession quite a bit.
Well, with that, I think we'll bring another episode to a close. So until next time, I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandaisy.
And we are the Shock Doctors. We'll see you later. As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from Swallow Official Trailer HD IFC Films, uploaded by IFC Films. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, May 16th, and we will be discussing Sun, a film about a cult escapee and her mysteriously ill child. See you then.